Thank you, Mr. Forsoff. Now, unfortunately, the time has progressed a lot, so we will try to nevertheless end with a beautiful note, which is the idea of classical culture. Now, I think yesterday evening, when we had the wonderful concert, which integrated both the professionals with the, you know, people who are in the learning process, and this indeed was so moving that, you know, I think most of us who, you know, were there could not help to have tears in their eyes and were carried away by, you know, a pretaste of what kind of a world would be possible if, you know, this evil would not exist. Now, I don't know if Bruce Fein is still here, but, you know, I have this standing controversy with him about the nature of man. And I would like, actually, my opening remarks also for the short discussion which we could have is, I mean, obviously, if you look at the world today, it's full of evil, it's full of depravity, it is a systemic crisis, as Mr. Forsoff was just saying. But I think we should not be confused about what is the potential of mankind. And while we are in a dark age, I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, I mean, just think about the development of the human species, which is around only for a very short period of time. Recorded history in terms of writings is barely 200 generations. I mean, that's like yesterday. And in that short period of time, the development of science and technology has been quite impressive. A stone, which used to be used, you know, some thousand years ago to kill your neighbor, Faustkeil, today the size of the same instrument, you have an iPhone which has computer capability, where you can run economies from around the world, you have conferences, you know, you are absolutely incredibly connected and you can do all your work. Now, this is only a short period of time. Now, just think how mankind, if we make it, would look like in 1,000 years from now. In the same way, like the developed person today says, well, how ridiculous to use this stone to kill your neighbor. I have now the whole world in this little instrument. Just think, in 1,000 years from now, people will look back and say, ho, ho, these ridiculous people from 2013, they thought an iPhone was something special. They will look at the iPhone as if it would be a Faustkeil, you know. So I think we should not be limited by the present condition of civilization, but have an idea that if we have this scientific and technological and industrial reconstruction of the world, and combine that with the classical education, the aesthetical education Schiller and, you know, others were talking about, why should we not be able to develop civilization in such a way that in the future, you know, okay, I mentioned four-year-old boys who kick you against the knee. I mean, that probably will always be like that because children are simply, especially little boys, tend to be, you know, uncontrollable little monsters at a certain age. But, you know, then they grow up. And my vision of the future of civilization is that we get rid of these children diseases, like all the emotions which go along with the globalization. And just imagine if every child on the planet would have universal education, which would have parents which would be concerned about the creative potential of the children to be developed. Why should that not be possible? I think the age of reason, which Schiller was talking about, is not a utopia which is a utopia. But I think that we are, you know, in a transition phase where if we make the new paradigm, that we have a future of civilization where people have their identity to be scientists, to be creative composers, poets, engineers, teachers, parents, but have their identity completely different to the devoted and be devoted to the progression of civilization. I think that that is the true identity of mankind if we are going to make it as a civilization in space. So, you know, I think that we have the incredible responsibility of making that transition, you know, to leave this world of, you know, what I would really like to call oligarchical childhood diseases behind us, and, you know, that, you know, in a certain sense, there will be never a second Beethoven, there will be never a second Schiller, but in the realm of freedom, I think the degrees of freedom, in the realm of creativity, the degrees of freedom are limitless. And I think we should have this idea of mankind becoming a truly creative species where, you know, the majority of people will be creative and not slaves. So that is something to work for and fight for. And, you know, I think the great classical art is really the way how to get there. And therefore, I want to give the word now to Antonella.
Okay. So after you, I can shut up because it's you told already. So Helga and Lynn gave me this chance to talk to you as a chance to open my mind and my heart, and maybe this can have a good effect on you. Maybe I will say something interesting, but for sure it will be helpful for me, because trying to be clear in my mind, this will help me. So I was thinking this in the last 2 days, that the reality of human experience on planet Earth is incredibly limited in terms of space, time, and any other parameters with which the concept of life can be expressed. Man is not so much a terrestrial being with an eternal or universal part, a soul. Rather, man is a creative fantasy of the universe, a momentary manifestation of its power of invention. So the great mind of the universe experiments with itself through man. We are eternity incarnated. In this moment, imprisoned in a small material reality. Perhaps I can imagine that the human adventure occupies the time of a snap in the mind of God. And in our mind, we still have the echo of that snap. Our human senses can be compared to our small earthly reality. And most people live their experience on Earth only through the senses. Their earthly life becomes the only reason for their existence, without being able or willing to really see, to really listen, to really feel, and to really understand how to be something, how to be protagonist in the universe. Life that is linked to senses, only to senses, is a life with no sense or purpose. It's like living in the entrance hall of a wonderful, marvelous castle, marvelous palace. So the most important senses for a man are the interior senses. And art, through art, through the exterior senses, develops the interior ones. Only the intellectual senses allow us to discover the power, the greatness, the wonder of the human creature and how we can be protagonists in the universe. the intellectual senses form a clear mind that can receive from eternity. A mind that has intuition, that is open, projected like a ray of energy towards something that is infinito. And to break through darkness of the ignorance, because it is the ignorance that can make us prison, like prison in this earth. And so we need not a dream, because you dream in the night. We need a vision. We need to see, to foresee something that can be, and not in the future, now. So no act of true art or true science exists or is done only for here and only for now. Only true art or true science have in themselves the vision of something that surpasses time and space, that contain the intuition of the architecture of the universe and how all of us and everything is an incarnation of the universe. So to me, to be able to conceive the absolute is what can get us free from now and here. I was thinking before to the telephone. Okay, this is useful, this is great, but this is style, this is design, but this is not beauty. If we think that this object is true science, is true art, we misunderstand. Because this doesn't contain eternity or something that is value. So, something I would like to say something else. That music for me and a musician is like a time machine. And not in the sense that when I perform music, I'm performing something that is from 200 years ago, 20 years ago. It's not in that sense. It's in the sense that using time and sounds that are happening in the time, so now and here, I can be traveled in a place where is no time and also is nowhere and everywhere in the same time. So if I listen to a music or a musician that is not able to travel me somewhere else and in a place that is not here and now, I have the sense that that music is not a great music, or that music is a classical music or whatever, but it's not done in a good way, in a beautiful way. Maybe you remember a movie, to me a great movie, is Shawshank Redemption. Maybe somebody of you can remember. And how the music of Mozart was used to uplift the prisoners in the yard of the prison. So there were these two voices, because it was the duetto of Le Nozze di Figaro, Sull'aria, Che Suave Zeffiretto. There were these two voices coming from the reign of beauty, and they were like two birds, wonderful birds, that they were playing in the air, dancing, designing continuously, and entering in the earth of every prisoner and opening their heart and giving hope and enlightening their mind, and like to enter really in another reign, because in this reign you don't need to understand words, you don't need to understand Italian or German or whatever, because when your mind is really in contact with the mind of the universe, it's really speaking the same language. And I hope for myself as person, as musician, to have, because sometimes I have had this sense of contact, of similarity, of my mind, of my imagination, with imagination of the universe. I can also say the imagination of God. So I wish for myself to find even more this connection, and I wish for all of us to have this feeling that we are speaking in our mind the same language of the universe, that is the language of beauty, is the language of something that is eternal and that you can recreate every moment you make something beautiful. I wish this.
Now I want to give the word to John.
Hi. Many years ago, it seems like many years ago, I performed for the first time a song cycle by Schumann called the Dichterliebe, the Poet's Love. I worked very hard on it with an accompanist at the time, and we performed it in New York City. And about a week later, Lynn issued a memo which totally shocked me, because I had been thinking about the Dichterliebe as a very sensitive, loving piece. And Lynn wrote a memo, said, "You know, this is the most rip-roaringly funny piece that I've ever heard. And anybody who is not rolling on the floor with laughter just doesn't get it." And that really made me think a lot about what music and what art represents. And ever since that time, that's been I've hoped to work towards that, and I hope to get other people to work towards that, because it brings up this question of what is sometimes called irony, which really is much more better talked about as metaphor. And it's embodied, I mean, if people know that particular song cycle, which I'd love to perform for you sometime, the song Ich grolle nicht, where the young idiot who's been rejected by his lover is saying, ich grolle nicht, I bear no grudge, I bear no grudge, I bear no grudge. And of course he does. And my sense of working on music since then, and I think this is the way Mozart and Beethoven and all the great composers looked at it, is that that the way that you get at this question of beauty, you have to go beyond just the beautiful tones, however ethereal, however beautiful, wafting through, but you also have to get at these critical juxtapositions, these seeming paradoxes, which can only be solved by jumping to a higher level. And indeed, in the Dichterliebe, that's exactly what is necessary, and that's what happens at the end of the song cycle, where Schumann takes Heinrich Heine's somewhat bitter poetry. Because Heinrich Heine was struggling with the collapse of civilization following the defeat of the American revolutionary spirit in the early 19th century. And he struggled with that his whole life, very valiantly. but very bitterly in some cases. Schumann lifts this to a completely new level, where he resolves it in the realm of beauty. And I see the same thing in Mozart. The Requiem is a truly revolutionary piece. Mozart's Requiem is a truly revolutionary piece. And I just wanted to point out one thing, for people to think about. The opening, you have the Requiem. It opens with the theme, with the chorus. And then after that, the soprano stands up, if you remember. Annabelle stood up and sang, Te decet hymnus Deus in Sion, et tibi redetur votum in Jerusalem, which means to thee a song, a hymn, you deserve a hymn, a God in Sion. And I always wondered where that came from and why that particular melody. Is that something that Mozart just made up? And it turns out, I discovered the answer only recently working with J.S. Bach, which is that in his famous Magnificat, in one of the sections, I was wondering what the flutes or the oboes were doing when they were holding these long notes at the top of one of the sections. And it turns out it's the same melody. And looking into it further, it turns out that this is a very old melody that goes back centuries, which was based on it was a old Gregorian hymn, which was based on what was called the tonus peregrinus, the wandering tone and the wandering mode. And to people listening to Mozart, even at his time, this would have been known. But I think everybody even knows it now in one way or another, maybe not consciously, maybe subconsciously, maybe preconsciously through the generations that have come before. And then if you start thinking about that little melody, which is Te decet hymnus Deus in Sion, and then you think of the Requiem, and you see that it's the same melody. And so this really brings me back to what the idea of Glass-Steagall and the FDR tradition. Because what we're doing here and what has to be done in art is to take the best of all previous generations and to make it worthwhile by raising it to a new level. That's why in the Recordare, one of my favorite phrases there in the Recordare section is Tantus labor non sit casus. Don't let all this work be in vain. And I would just like to leave you with that thought.
Liliane, our leader from the Movisol from Italy.
Okay, I know you're all tired and we're almost done, but I also want to tell you, like John, a personal story, which is my personal encounter with the music project, and particularly with Lyndon LaRouche, when in 1987, I was already a member in the organization for 10 years, but I had the pleasure and honor of being invited to Virginia for a special project there, which was, I'm not sure if it was the Coronation Mass or the Requiem, but for sure it was supposed to be with the lower tuning. It was the first time that we decided to perform Mozart with C256, with the almost half a tone difference in respect to all the orchestras in the world. And Mr. LaRouche was inspiring this project and telling us, I don't care how you do it, put the scotch tape on the bassoons, do whatever you have to do to make sure that the wind instruments go down with the tuning, and that the voices are respected, and that the connection between science and music is respected. And as most Italians, this made me very curious, because the project was very interesting. I even sang in it, and it was a lot of work. It was very, very successful. But the next day I came back to Milan, and I said, Lino LaRouche is normally right on economics, on everything he says, so he must be right also on this one. And I decided to go and check, because if this is true, I'm sure Italian musicians must have discovered the same. And I went to the Milan Conservatory. Many people of you know this story, but there may be a few who are new. And I found this letter of Giuseppe Verdi of 1884, which said exactly the same as Lin was saying to us, which is, it was a letter to the government, which had a committee at that time to change the tuning of the military bands and also the orchestras. And he said, dear committee, I understand from our experts and scientists that the Paris A of A435 is not scientific enough. If there are scientific reasons to lower it to what the scientists said is the most good tuning for the voice and for the instruments, I gladly endorse this, and I will be glad that the noble sound of the human voice can be heard instead of the shouts of a very high pitch, which is what we normally hear today in most opera houses, and particularly, as I said yesterday, in Salzburg, Berlin, and Florence, where the A went up to A448. Which is really almost one tone higher than the original composers. So based on this letter, the Schiller Institute launched the campaign to go back to Verdi's tuning, which was endorsed at that time by more than 2,000 singers, opera singers, including Renata Tebaldi, Pavarotti, Domingo, Mirella Freni, John Sutherland, Carlo Bergonzi, who sent a message also endorsing our concert last night, and Antonella Banaudi. That's how I met her, because she sang, she won the prize for Verdi voices in Busseto, the hometown of Verdi, and which was led by Bergonzi. And at the end of the concert, I contacted her with this campaign, and she said, sure, I support you fully. What should we do? Let's go. We have a conference, we do an example. And that's what we did. We did a conference in Milan in the Casa Verdi. If you have 2 minutes of patience, can we show this? I'll show you an example. This is not Antonella. This is Piero Capocilli, the famous baritone, Verdi baritone Una Dai. And you will see also Renata Tebaldi. For those of you who know opera stars, you will recognize her. And is making an example in the two tunings. First, in the low, we had the piano in the Casa Verdi tuned low to A432, and then with the grand piano in the high tuning. It's bad, the quality, but you get the idea. says, let's try the other one. And there is Renata Tebaldi and myself. And this is the Casa Verdi, which Verdi had built for pure musicians. He was also a political leader in Italy. He said, he said also the color is completely different. It's not only that it's harder to sing it in this way, because it shifts, all the register shifts. In the first part, he could sing in the second register, a long note. In the other version, he had to shift to the high notes, which was not what Verdi meant. And based on this conference, we also found confirmation of what Lina had to say, because we had Norbert Breinin, the famous first violin of the Amadeus Quartet, who was at this conference, and he also came with me to Cremona, invited by the Scuola di Liuteria, the violin building school of Cremona, and it turned out that the Stradivari, Guarneri, Amati, all the ancient and precious violins of the old school in Italy were built exactly for the C256 tuning, which, and there was an experiment quoted in the Verdi papers by Savart and Sauveur, two French physicists, which is to shoot two or three octaves into the violin. When it gets to the C256, you see that the C of the violin tries to sympathetic vibration, as a sympathetic vibration. So that showed. And Breinin did this with the famous Il Cremonese violin, which is the only Stradivari kept in Cremona, which is still the original, has not been prolonged, as they did with most violins, in order to get a higher tuning. And he confirmed completely that also not only the voices, but also the violins are destroyed by this high tuning. And after this initiative, we continued. We had even a law proposal in Italy to lower tuning. And as you know, the campaign is still going on, because last night we had this concert in Verdi tuning. And we hope that during the Verdi year, this is the 200th anniversary of his birth, other people besides us will get the bright idea of respecting what Verdi's will was. And the other thing which Verdi, where Verdi fully agrees with Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche and with Mr. LaRouche, is the question of going back to Renaissance and to the classics. And he said it explicitly in his letters. He said, torniamo all'antico, sarà un progresso. Let's return to classics. It will be a progress. And he explicitly said, students, like also Schumann, he has similar recommendations for students, not only of music, but students of everything. He said, you should go back to Dante, to Shakespeare, to Schiller. Study the classics. Go back in history so that you can have really a future. And we had a wonderful demonstration of this last night with Antonella's Tutte le vanità from Don Carlos, which I think is one of the most powerful and political operas of Verdi, based on Schiller's libretto. And not only on Schiller's libretto, but I believe, I don't have confirmation, I believe that Verdi read Schiller's letters on the Don Carlos, because they indicate precisely what the characters show in the opera. What Schiller said, for example, about the friendship between Posa and Don Carlos, they were inspired both by the same love for the great and the beautiful. And they had a joint mission, which was to free the Flanders from the domination of the empire, the Spanish Empire, which was very similar situation to today. In 1557, Spain was going through a financial collapse. The debt was putting all the economy into a collapse, and that's why they were exploiting the colonies, the Flanders, other countries, to get money, to steal money, treating the population terribly. So this was a very political project, which fails because Don Carlos is obsessed by what Schiller calls Schwärmerei in the letters, which is the love for his previous fiancée, Elisabetta, which was the character Antonella was performing last night, Elisabetta di Valois, who used to be his girlfriend, and he cannot overcome this. He has all these regrets towards his father, who married her, and he loses this battle, he loses this mission he has in the Flanders because of the lack of courage in dealing with his personal problems. This is something most of us go through in our lives, in our personal life. Many of us have this fight between what is our mission, what should we do? We should do campaign for Glass-Steagall, we should go organize, we should convince people to make a new economic system. And, oh, today I feel so sad, today I feel so painful, my girlfriend has dumped me, nobody wants me, I have no friends. So this is what art is teaching people in a beautiful way. It is teaching it not like the nun in the church. You have to be good. It is teaching it with beauty. So it's not heavy. It's a message which you can take because it is beautiful. But it is certainly teaching people how to change their lives in order to be able to face the mission which they have to change the world. And this is, again, I have to say, most of what I learned in these 40 years in the organization I owe to Mr. LaRouche, something he said in these first meetings we had about the music project in Virginia, when he said, I don't care who is coming to the opera to show, he didn't say Armani, but to show the Armani dress or to just to make bella figura. What is important is the guy in the last row who is really hiding in the opera is there almost by chance. But when he's at the end of this opera, he will come out of that opera house transformed, a different person. And I believe the concert last night had this effect on most of you, and particularly those who had not experienced classical music before. And that's what art is all about. Thank you.
Now we have a problem that we are really running out of time. So I would just say that one of the violin players from the piano yesterday, who is also a student of Norbert Preinin, he has put up a new petition for the lower tuning. The address we will publish on the Schiller New Paradigm website. And I would ask all of you to, you know, help to make it known and what it involves. So I also would say that since I heard that there are many questions in the room which we impossibly can answer now because of time reasons, that people should feel encouraged to send these questions by email or even, you know, set up some other kind of telephone, because I think some of the speakers would be more than happy to answer questions even beyond this short opportunity. But having said all of this, I would say that we have now another couple of minutes, 10 minutes maybe. So if people have pressing issues to any of the speakers on the podium, please go ahead.
Hello.
My name is Matthias, and I have a simple question for the future work of me, to Linden. Please tell me, how can I motivate my friends to take responsibility for people they will never know? So how can I achieve the people around me to get more involved to work for the future?
Who do you ask the question to? Linden.
Lynn, yeah. So.
Well, first of all, you have to be convinced yourself.
Pardon?
You have to be convinced yourself.
Yeah.
You have to define your own self-confidence. And you really have to decide to make a breakthrough.
A what?
A breakthrough. That is not the same old, same old. What?
Just closer.
A closer. Oh, my God. It's getting very intimate here. Anyway. No, the point is, it depends upon you. First of all, you have to have a reason, a motivation for doing, experiencing something yourself. And it's on the basis of wishing to express that for yourself. And it can come in two ways. You wish to express something which is in you. And you find that when you try to do that, you stumble. And then if you get help, you find that if you're cooperating with somebody and you're trying to do the same thing as in song, you find it may work. So you actually have to do experimentally. You're exploring yourself and trying to find out where the fault in yourself is which prevents you from doing something. Or maybe it's a physical problem, a performance. But you have to settle the question in yourself. And if you can solve the problem, solve it. Okay. If you can't solve it, try doing something indirect on the problem. Promote it. Getting other people to do it. Getting people to agree, let's try to do this. I'm having trouble doing this. Let's try to do this. And I think a lot of inspiration, the greatest performers, I think they often get to that exactly that way, by getting to something which suddenly they make a breakthrough. And only when you get to this challenge of making a breakthrough do you really understand what it's all about. It's that understanding.
Thank you very much.
Hello. I have a simple question, but to you all, whoever you want to respond. How do you recognize what is real classical art and what is not?
There's a very good example of this. It's the case of Beethoven in his later years. And it's a humiliating lesson for people who have difficulty in singing. It's a terrible lesson. Because Beethoven was at a point where he was composing where he could not rely upon his ability to hear. He could not rely on. But he actually composed his greatest compositions in complexity and achievement came in his later performances at a time he could no longer hear. He would direct a performance, a public performance, which he himself could not hear and do it accurately. And the point is that it is not the sound of your voice which is music. It's the sound inside your head. Which is it? The idea. We operate in the domain of ideas, not of experimental noises. I'm not trying to find a beautiful noise. It's something inside you. It's a passion inside you to do something you have never done before, an accomplishment you never made before. And it's only when people go through that And, you know, some teacher or some coach, for example, will get them, look, try. And when they make a breakthrough of finding out how to do something, which they were always capable of doing potentially, and they make that breakthrough, that and they force themselves to dare to make that breakthrough. They may not do it too well, but then they know what they've got, and they will try again, and they will become successful.
Hello. I wanted to talk in, to speak in German. Because of this, you need your... Okay. Hallo. Mein Name ist Marius Lickfett, ich komme aus dem Rheintal in Remagen. Es ist unglaublich schön dort, ich liebe dieses Land, beziehungsweise das Rheintal. Und meine Frage ist speziell, oder was heißt, ja, in meinem Freundeskreis machen wir, warte, wie kann ich es genauer ausdrücken, wir haben eine sehr, sehr verbundene Beziehung. Wir lieben uns, beziehungsweise auf eine freundschaftliche Ebene. Vor allem mit meinem Bruder. Wir sind zusammen gereist eine gewisse Zeit und haben die Menschen kennengelernt, haben uns kennengelernt, haben halt auch gelernt, dass man die Menschen so lassen muss, beziehungsweise man kann den Menschen zwar etwas mitteilen, aber man kann sie nicht dazu zwingen. Das habe ich gelernt. Also auch aus meiner Kindheit. Unser Vater hat nie versucht, uns etwas aufzuzwingen. Und dadurch haben wir uns selbst erfahren. Wir wussten lange nicht, wer wir sind, aber gerade dadurch haben wir uns eigentlich selbst gefunden, weil wir nie irgendetwas anderes, uns nie irgendwie anpassen mussten. Und dennoch, also vor allen Dingen auch, wenn wir Musik machen, jammen, vielleicht kennen Sie das, dann fügt sich halt auch alles zum einen. Wir lachen uns an, wir freuen uns, wir komponieren neue Sachen, zwar nicht auf die Art und Weise, wie das wie Beethoven, aber schon, es ist doch eigentlich schon absolute kreative Arbeit. Ne? Und worauf ich eigentlich hinaus möchte, ist, dass ich meinen Freunden halt auch von der Bürgerrechtsbewegung erzählt habe und sie finden es Ansätze ganz gut, aber sie würden halt nicht den Schritt gehen, den ich gehen werde. Und letztendlich, also ich kann mir irgendwie auch nicht mehr ein Leben ohne diese Menschen vorstellen. Wir haben quasi eine Lebensgemeinschaft. Und letztendlich weiß ich nicht, was ich machen soll. Also ich verstehe, worum es letztendlich in dieser Bürgerrechtsbewegung geht, was sie erreichen will. Echt diese Kreativität und Leidenschaft und ja, also was der Mensch halt erreichen kann, ne? Abgesehen von dem Tier, dass er die Kreativität hat und wirklich zum Mars kommen kann, das ist mir bewusst. Aber dennoch unterliege ich halt dementsprechend, kann man sagen, meinen Gefühlen zu meiner Familie, die essentiell für mich ist. Und wenn ich der Büse beitreten sollte, dann glaube ich, würde ich sie halt letztendlich verlieren, beziehungsweise natürlich werden wir uns nie ganz verlieren, aber auf eine gewisse Art und Weise, weil man sich vielleicht 2 Wochen nicht sieht oder länger und irgendwann will man mal Familie haben, hat man nicht gesehen. Jeder entwickelt sich auch dementsprechend und davor habe ich halt Angst, diese Menschen zu verlieren. Und ja, was letztendlich ist es Angst, das weiß ich auch, aber sie ist absolut gerechtfertigt. Ja, aber dennoch bin ich halt in der Zwickmühle, genau.
An wen ist die Frage gerichtet?
Eigentlich, also generell an alle, aber ich hatte hauptsächlich auch Sie damit angesprochen.
Herrn LaRouche.
Nee, Sie, Frau. Oh, Sepp LaRouche.
Okay. Okay, I'll answer in English for the benefit of...
Okay, for sure.
Well, I think that everybody who joined this movement was confronted with this problem. Because, you know, because what my husband has done is basically to lift us out of a life which, you know, was more or less a normal life. You know, people would pursue their studies or their family life or whatever. And, you know, in a certain sense, you don't meet, and I apologize that I say this because I'm not prejudiced because I'm married to him, but you know, you meet a person like my husband maybe once a century. And I was very happy when the guest from China said, you know, he's a Confucian mentor. And, you know, other people have said he's in the tradition of Vernadsky in Russia, or, you know, he's... Anyway, so, you know, when we met him, you know, it was like an earthquake, a thunderstorm which completely changed the way you look at it. Because if you meet a Plato or you meet a Leibniz or a Beethoven, you know, I mean, I think that that changes your life. Now, in the beginning, you know, I mean, there were incredible obstacles. People said, oh, you want to do this crazy thing. Don't think you can change history. You are just a little sand corn on the ocean. You know, the waves will come and push you away. And, you know, it takes this initial strength to say, no, I will devote my life to something better. I will, you know, given the fact that, you know, anybody who has a heart and a mind and who sees in what terrible condition this civilization is. I mean, Africa is dying. Who cares about Africa? You know, you have millions of children dying, you know, and nobody cares, at least not in the advanced, so-called advanced sector. You have an incredible menticide going on. If you look at the youth, I mean, for me, this is, even if I'm in politics with my whole heart for a very, very long time, when I see the condition of the youth now, you know, where you have reports almost every day that 12-year-olds are raping 11-year-olds, and they are making pornographic videos and put them in the internet, or they, you know, use guns. When 4-year-olds shoot their parents because the gun is running around, I cannot look at the condition of civilization knowing what is a positive image of man. I mean, fortunately, I had the you know, luck that I had 3 good German teachers who, you know, did never speak about the 20th century, but they always spoke about Schiller, Lessing, Mörike, and all these other beautiful poets. So my image was extremely formed by, for example, if you read the letter exchanges between Schiller and Humboldt, Schiller and Körner, Schiller and Goethe, for that matter, you know, you see how a human relation can be, that human beings can struggle for the most beautiful ideas, and that is the basis of their social relationship. Now, if I confront these letter exchanges from this period to the SMS of today or the Twitter of today, you have a degree of how much man has shrunken in their communication. And I think it's one of the big curses that in future historians will say, what was the relationship between these people? Oh, this SMS and that SMS. And, you know, it will be a mirror of where we have, why we are in such a dark age. So when you see all of that and you have a love for mankind, then you have to have a compassion that you do everything with your life possible to not leave it like that. But, you know, most children have no chance. They have, if they don't meet at least one individual, a teacher, a parent, who gives this divine spark in them, they will become vegetables and take drugs and take, you know, be involved in this horrible youth culture, which is based on ugliness, on violence, and so forth. So, you know, if you have any passion for mankind, you have to do what we do. There is simply no other way. And in the beginning, you will meet some friends who will turn out not to be friends. Many people think friendship is friendship, but then it turns out when the first test comes, there, you know, there were just warm bodies in a winter night, you know, or people you do banal things with, and, you know, when the first challenge comes, it's not a real friendship. On the other side, you know, those of us who stuck with it, and some of us are in this for a very long time, you know, we are now appreciated by our parents as the only ones who are not black sheep, because all the others are divorced or have, you know, many, many, you know, symptoms of the present culture. So, you know, this is a transformation. You have to have a little patience, because afterwards people appreciate you for what you had the vision to show them. And those which are valuable will be with you, and those which are not valuable you lose. That's the price, but I think the price to be gained is what Nicolaus of Cusa called the sweetness of truth, which is much sweeter than any other thing you can know. And since we are really, we have a tremendous responsibility. You know, I think that the few people in the planet who really understand where civilization is at, you know, they have a tremendous responsibility, because we are on the verge of extinction of civilization. And we are the few people, relatively speaking, who have knowledge how it works, because we have never given up whenever we were attacked. We did not capitulate like other people, but we said, who is attacking us? Why? Let's find out. You know, and that's how we have, you know, one of the best private intelligence capabilities of anybody. And that is why, you know, in a certain sense, we are feared, despite the fact that we have no physical power. We have not large amounts of money. We have only the insight into the laws of the universe. And I think that that is, you know, why I'm optimistic after all of these many struggles, that the laws of the universe are with us. And they're with us for the same reasons what Antonella said, you know, because I believe that, you know, while I cannot guarantee this or that, but I believe that we are in tune with the lawfulness of the universe, and our opponents are a disease which, you know, will eventually vanish. So be optimistic and join. So, okay, one last question.
Yeah, well, maybe you want to say something on what we're going to do tomorrow, because we have also we have our youth movement. We have people here who are partly working with us, who are new people, who have known us for a long time. But we need really to defend our citizenship of our nations, and we can very quickly establish that we contact our parliamentarians, and I think, for example, we have now in the United States this fantastic call with organizers, and we also have that in Germany every Saturday, and one can get on. Every German can get on this call. We brief you, and we can help you to actually organize the parliamentarian in your district. Because it's very urgent right now that Glass-Steagall comes through, and I think it's very important to see this as the preparation for what we're going to do tomorrow. So I just wanted to add that, and you can probably say more.
Okay, so I want to give the concluding word to Lynn.
Oh my. Okay. The most thing I desire the most from all of you, and many people beyond, is to cease having confidence in what happened yesterday. The only thing that is really worthwhile, when you know you're living in a troubled universe anyway, you know that you cannot continue to do what you are doing, because what you are doing is leading you nowhere. Now, therefore, the solution lies in definition in the question of future. Do you know a better future? Now, this is not merely a matter of choice of choosing a future. You have to be right. It would be a terrible thing to make a mistake. And what's your passion to know what the true future potential is? But take the case of Beethoven, as I referred to earlier today. Beethoven was deafened to a degree at which, in his last public performances, direction of his own compositions, he had trouble in matching what the orchestra was doing with his own composition. And yet he was right. And the reason was that this man was composing brilliantly in terms of composition of ideas. He was at the acme of his capability and still inspiring people. And yet he could not hear. And yet he had been deaf for years. And this past ability to hear was disappearing all along. And yet in this precise period, this man's mind was doing the greatest creation that he ever did before. Therefore, the thing that's important about human beings and what's bad about them in their performance is they believe in sense perception. They believe in the sense perception that has been heard, or the sense perception they want wish to hear immediately, without forgetting recklessly, finding what the actual future might be. The most precious thing in society is the development of people in society who have a prescience of the future, of what the present is leading to. You don't see the present only. You see the process of the past leading into the present. Now, can you know what the future is going to bring? Now, I've done this repeatedly. Other people, who are usually exceptional people, have done the same thing. To see for, you know, I've often said, and been right, when I said 5 years from now is about the limit before this new development is going to occur. It could be more or less, but it's in those kinds of ranges. I've often prophesied in the sense of ranges, and I've been right. Now, this is the same principle that you see demonstrated by all great composers. All great composers. The principle is foresee the future by seeing a better quality of idea, of importance of idea in the future at a relatively greater distance. This is most essential, because otherwise, how can you judge what you should do with your life or do for humanity during your life? How can you prove that choice was not a waste of time? That your whole life is a waste of time because you didn't know the idea you should have been able to know? And that's what makes all creativity. You can, if you really understood Shakespeare's performances in drama, a good performance of Shakespeare, you come into the same thing. You realize that you are gradually foreseeing the future development within that drama. All great musical opera, classical opera, the same thing, classical song, the same thing. The opera is useful for this process because it does involve a lapse of time. Can you foresee the irony of what's going to happen in the future in that drama, on a classical drama? Can you apply that ability to a real life experience? Well, I'm telling you, man is perfectly capable of doing that. It's a species capability of a human being. It what makes the difference between a human being and a beast. And you all have possession to it. You simply have to take charge of your possession.
So with that, this Schiller conference is concluded.